discussion of the charges being dropped against those who were involved in the encampment, Misavica?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we know that some of the misdemeanors and summons have been dropped thus far by the DA. None of the felony charges have been dropped so far from the encampment itself. And we know that the DA cannot prosecute or would have a really hard time, you know, upholding these charges if CUNY administration refused to meaningfully participate in the prosecution. So we're calling on the administration to refuse to participate in the prosecution. And this is, again, why one of our demands is that CUNY stop retaliating and repressing its pro-Palestine students and workers. I mean, this is really the most egregious example we've seen of violent repression of pro-Palestinian organizing and views.
And Professor Vitale, we only have about 30 seconds, but could you talk about the Cops Off Campus Coalition and the significance, for instance, of Portland State students successfully getting a disarmament of their campus police?
CUNY is spending millions of dollars for a security apparatus that that fails to address the real security needs of students and is really there in moments like this to be a tool, a kind of private army for the administration to suppress student dissent. Campuses should quit wasting educational dollars on producing their own police forces that just reproduce the same violence and the same kinds of overt control of protest activity that we see from the NYPD and other local police departments around the country. So this is part of a national movement of young people saying, we don't feel safe just because you put a bunch of armed police officers on our campus. We want real services that meet our real needs.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Alex Vitale, professor of sociology, coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at CUNY's Brooklyn College, author of The End of Policing, and Misavica Nabiha, a CUNY alum and Palestine organizer. We'll link to the 500-professor letter at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, May 20th at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive, taking place now through May 25th. Your contribution goes towards postmodern, avant-garde, alternative radio. Donate now by going to bit.ly/KBOO. Thank you.
I'm at KBOO.fm. Them should know it's accurate. Kabaka Pyramid say watch your step, you know what I mean?
You're listening to KBOO Portland's 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
Unkindness rewrote my autobiography. Punchlines in guts, blades for tongues, and a mouth pregnant with thunder. Your unkindness told me to push through, look, listen. I was born on the 50th anniversary of the Nakba, to a mother that reaped olives and figs and other Quranic verses. What dini was zaytun? My name, a bomb in a white room, a walking suspicion in an airport, choiceless politics. I was born on the 50th anniversary of the Nakba.
Outside the hospital room, protest, textured with burnt rubber, graffitied faces and bare bodies. Stones thrown onto tanks, tanks imprinted with US flags, lands smelling of tear gas, skies tiled with rubber-coated bullets, a few bodies shot, dead, died, numbers in a headline, I and my sister born, birth that's longer than death. In Palestine, death is sudden, instant, constant, happens in between breaths. I was born amongst poetry on the 50th anniversary. The liberation chants outside the hospital room told my mother to push.
Yes, and good morning to everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I'm Paul Rowland. I'll be with you for the next hour until 9 o'clock. And as you heard, have been hearing, it is the 76th anniversary of the Nakba. And we will be talking about that today, amongst other things. And KBOO is actually acknowledging it with some special programming. At 10 o'clock is a Palestine-Israel teach-in. KBOO Portland section for Radio Free Palestine broadcast prepared by our former staffer, Jenka Soderberg. At 11 a.m., we have special programming by Radio Free Palestine, a live stream by WPFW in Washington, D.C., my old community radio station. And this evening at 6 o'clock, Palestinian Unions, yes, program building bridges out of WBAI in New York City. So we got all that lined up for you today. And of course, we're kicking it off. Well, of course, Democracy Now! Kicked it off as Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez and the Democracy Now! Crew have been covering so thoroughly this horrible ongoing disaster, genocide in Gaza. It is also our spring membership drive, yes. And we are encouraging you to support this kind of programming, which you will get here on KBOO Community Radio. We have been having some problems with our website. I see it's up now. So you're certainly welcome to go to kbo.fm/give. But we also have another link, which is bit.ly/kbu. In case you're having trouble going to the website, I do see it's up right now. So that's, of course, kbo.fm as usual. You can also donate on the KBOO app and by mail as usual at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. I believe you can also text KBOO to 44321. Not sure that's been affected by the website problems, but I said it's up and it should be going. I haven't heard any updates about the website, but it is there now. And we do depend on your support. We depend on our listeners to keep this radio station going. So we really appreciate your getting to helping us toward our goal of $60,000 by May 25th. Okay, we'll be talking about that some more. I did want to start out by, I'm sorry. I didn't say who that was. The song that started this out was My Nakba Birthday by Mohammed El Kurd, K-U-R-D, and Clarissa Bitar, B-I-T-A-R. It's on YouTube. My Nakba Birthday. So, I have kind of an ambitious framing that I hope to achieve here, and I hope you will join me at, I'm all by myself, by the way, at 503-231-8187. So I believe that, well, some people just are mystified why the United States is such an absolute bedrock supporter of, is uncritical. I mean, yeah, now there's, they've been forced to finally, you know, they suspended, 3,500 bombs, and now they've celebrated the Nakba, the Biden administration, by sending $1 billion of military aid. So they're not going to be able to drop this new crop of 3,000-pound bombs. But of course, they probably still have some. They have other bombs, and they're going to have all this military equipment from the United States, which they've been running this war on from the beginning, United States and other countries, but by far from the United States. So why is the United States such a supporter? And I assume most of you out there have some inkling of it, but we're going to try to get into that. I link it to, well, it obviously goes back to the creation of the State of Israel, which is what nobody really wants to talk about. Nobody wants to actually call into question. It's taboo to call into question the circumstances surrounding the creation of the State of Israel, because it was so linked to the horrors of World War II and the Holocaust, the genocidal military machine of Adolf Hitler and his minions, which resulted in the death of so many millions of Jews and other people. And the Zionist project of establishing a State of Israel long predated the Holocaust, and it was not, initially it was not widely supported by Jews, as far as I know. There is a lot, I think, non or anti-Zionism was more the status quo among the Jewish diaspora, as far as I am aware of, and it's only been through the forcible creation of the State of Israel and the drumbeat of propaganda and the massive extreme importance of the State of Israel to the geopolitical designs of the United States and Great Britain and other states, that the Zionist project succeeded beyond, I guess, their wildest dreams in terms of establishing it as something that can't be questioned or criticized. But thank goodness for the youth of today, the college-aged youth and others who have risen up and demanded that we pay attention to the genocide, to the absolute devastation that's going on in Gaza, and the amped up repression and killings in the West Bank, and the general amped up suppression, repression, oppression of Palestinians wherever they are, even in the State of Israel, the shutting down of Palestinian voices. They've refused to back down, and they've forced some kind of public conversation around this. Not for the first time, but I think there's something unprecedented about this, that, you know, it did actually force the small gesture of pausing the shipment of those large, high tonnage bombs to Israel. So let's go back and try to look at the circumstances, and then I'm going to link it, the settler colonial project in Palestine. I'm going to link it to the settler colonial all settler colonial projects, and especially the settler colonial project of the United States. And I would posit that in addition to not, there's two major denials going on here, major reasons why it's a taboo subject. The first and most immediate, most recent historically, is the whole geopolitical situation in the 20th century, specifically the World War I and its aftermath, World War II and its aftermath. Great Britain was still an empire at that time, still had a global empire, And so, and the establishment of the State of Israel was part of their trying to maintain that global empire and securing sources of petroleum and access to the Suez Canal and such. And of course, the United States was a rising global empire, and it wanted to secure the Middle East was such a key region, you know, because there's the vast amount of known petroleum reserves at that time. And going into the future, they're looking, you know, decades down the line, we're in the Middle East. Of course, they've since found other reserves. They've tapped what are called non-traditional petroleum sources since then, like the tar sands, and technology has enabled them to be able to tap those resources and also go into older oil fields and get more oil out, etc. So the establishment of the, you know, the colonial settler state of Israel was part of that hegemonic project by both the UK and the United States. And so calling into question the establishment of the State of Israel is calls into question that the actual hegemony or the pretense to hegemony, I think is increasingly a pretense to hegemony of the United States because of the rise of China mainly, and also the somewhat comeback of Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, not as strong as it was back then. So yeah, they don't want to call into question the American, what was the American century, and now they're trying to desperately maintain the American century into a new century. And the other part of it, I think, is a kind of a deeper one, which is the problematic nature of the nation state itself. Most nation states were forged in violence and often some kind of genocide of either ethnic indigenous peoples or ethnic minorities, tribal kinship-based populations, groups that. That's what the consolidation of nation states has meant, because very few of them are like, you know, one people that have lived in that place, just one people, or even a group of people that have gotten along and, you know, worked things out. No, most of them are born in violence and in suppression. And empires like the United States, Great Britain, you know, are born in violence abroad and suppression at home. As my man Stanley Diamond, who wrote In Search of the Primitive, excellent work, if you haven't taken a look at it ever, probably not. Probably very low on the list of books that are out there in the public consciousness. But so yeah, the idea of the nation state itself is problematic, and the, you know, people who criticize the circumstances, you know, whether questioning the existence of the State of Israel is a whole other question. You know, now that it exists, you know, yeah, I think the only my opinion, there is people who differ with this even, and I think it's possible even to differ on this. My opinion is that something's got to be worked out. But the working out means is recognizing the Palestinians as a state themselves, which, you know, the Israel is incapable of doing. They have no interest whatsoever in doing that. And so, yeah, calling into question the people like myself who call into question the circumstances of the creation of the State of Israel also call into question the circumstances of the creation of the United States of America, as I've done repeatedly, especially with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler on the second Wednesday of the month. And that's also quite a taboo subject. Of course, you know, with the uprisings, the 2020 uprisings, and the kind of a new consciousness, a somewhat new anti-colonial consciousness among young people that aren't so under the thrall of the nation state propaganda. You know, there's more willing to look at other models of social organization, like socialist models among the youth. You know, certainly still a probably a relatively small minority, but it's a lot bigger than it was. And people were questioning, and the form that took during the uprisings after the George Floyd murder, the toppling of a lot of the monuments. Of course, that had been going on before. This is not strictly new, but you know, calling into question the Civil War or the glorification in the South of the Civil War, and the glorification of the conquerors. You know, whether it's Christopher Columbus or others, some of the Spanish conquistadors, that's been a big part of it. And so, yeah, there is a questioning of the circumstances that brought about the establishment of the settler colonial state of the United States of America. And I think that's entirely good and necessary. And so in some ways, calling into question the circumstances of the creation of the state of Israel is calling into question, I think there's either a unconscious or conscious fear that would bring up, you know, calling into question the circumstances of the creation of the United States. Just like the United States resists participating in the International Criminal Court, any attempt to bring to justice for war crimes, any United States military personnel or political figures who are responsible for such deplorable, horrible actions, wars, as in the Gulf Wars, the war in Iraq, and the war in Afghanistan, and the inability to actually talk about genocide when it doesn't apply to, I don't know, someone, our political enemies. I say our, you know, because I am a citizen of the United States, after all, much as I might criticize it. I was born here. I live here. I'm sure I'll die here. And it does. I do believe that there's something at play with that, too, that calling into question is this circumstance of the creation of Israel also calls into question both, you know, the creation of the United States and other settler colonial states. You know, there's most of the South American countries were born in, I think all of them, born in the colonization, and many around the world. And many of the inheritors of that, you know, there were certainly anti-colonial movements that established governments that actually were trying to more or less completely overturn that legacy and actually create a different kind of society, not based on ruthless exploitation, in some cases not based on capitalist exploitation. Of course, those were the ones that the United States and other capitalist powers went after, because you can't have that. You can't have that kind of example. You know, the domino theory. And so, and also calls into question. So it calls into question both the creation of the state of Israel, the creation of the United States and other settler colonial states. And I think it calls into question in some ways the existence of the nation state itself as some kind of entity that can guarantee any kind of justice or even any kind of international order. You know, much as I idealistically still hold on to the idea of the United Nations as being, you know, always in potential. It's never, of course, it was also created largely as a tool for the maintenance of the status, the nation state status quo. You know, at that point, the Cold War status quo of the superpower United States and the superpower Soviet Union and their satellites and their spheres of influence. And of course, since the capitalist powers didn't tend to have the greater share of global hegemony, then it guaranteed more the status quo of the capitalist international regime, the ability to secure markets through economic pressure, and if that doesn't work, war, which the United States has always engaged in. So I think all that stuff is in play. So that's the broader context of the Nakba and the denial of the Nakba, the denial of, still the denial of the genocide of Native Americans and the horrors of chattel slavery of African peoples brought here in chains, mostly by the right wing, but I think it's the denial of the what that really meant for us today, for the fact that how we live today is based upon the established, the wealth generated, the expropriations and wealth extortion from labor and natural resources and land, that's what we live on today still, the capital from that. And I think most people are willing to go way deep into that and to question those foundations. And then, I guess, if that isn't enough, and I should give out my number once again. It's 503-231-8187 if you'd like to explore with me any of these subjects. And I have some stuff I'd like to read from as well, perhaps before we get into that. But the other thing is that all of this, the colonization of parts of Africa and the Americas, that is basically what led to the establishment of capitalism, the vast amounts of wealth, especially the metal wealth, silver and gold, to replenish the depleted royal treasuries of the constantly warring European nations. Still kingdoms at that point that were kind of morphing into the modern nation state. But that that wealth, and then the wealth generated by the slave trade, which helped create the English banking system, and that wealth, that historical process set in motion, it created capitalism and the Industrial Revolution. That whole globe, the first globalization, well, it wasn't the first globalization. You got to go back to, the Roman Empire and even before. But that 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century globalization set in motion what is now coming home to roost as the massive cumulative impact of the burning of all these fossil fuels, which is climate change. And I would posit that part of, a lot of especially younger people are really getting onto this, is that in order to deal with that, if it's even possible at this point, we may be well too late, is to acknowledge how it was set in motion by those forces, which even go further back, if you really want to get into it. What are the origins of imperialism? Someday, maybe on this show, we'll try to tackle that deeper question. But right now, we're talking about the Nakba. We're talking about all these internested historical legacies that are kicked down the road to never deal with. And my latest riff was on the United Nations, that I have this idealistic belief that in some kind of global cooperative framework, as it were, which of course has been continually undermined by, first and foremost, by the existence of the Security Council and the veto power of those nations in the Security Council, who are always just going to protect their own interests. But also, broader structural issues, as I said, with the problem of the nation state itself, with the problem of a global capitalist system, which is inherently unjust and inherently incapable of addressing the problems that it has created, along with the imperialist thrust historically. So it would be nice. It would be nice if we had a United Nations that actually functioned, that could actually produce to actually have some sort of power to enforce its high its good rhetoric. You do have these resolutions to recognize a state of Palestine. It keeps inching forward. They're not able to actually recognize a full Palestinian statehood, but they most recent resolution granted further recognitions to the Palestinian people as a state. And it would be nice, but of course, our country, first and foremost, the United States of America, is preventing that from happening by continuing to arm the world, continuing to have this military-industrial complex, which is preventing any progress on any front, really, including climate change. All right, well, I'm going to go and read a little bit from, first of all, what is the Nakba? It was the violent expulsion of approximately three-quarters of all Palestinians from their homes and homeland by Zionist militias and the new Israeli army during the State of Israel's establishment between 1947 and 49. It was a deliberate and systematic act intended to establish a Jewish majority state in Palestine. Amongst themselves, Zionist leaders used the euphemism transfer when discussing plans for what today would be called ethnic cleansing. This is from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. I don't know much about it. I think these facts are unproblematic. The roots of the Nakba and the ongoing problems in Palestine, Israel today lie in the emergence of political Zionism in the late 1800s, when some European Jews, influenced by the nationalism then sweeping the continent, decided that the solution to anti-Semitism in Europe and Russia was the establishment of a state for Jews in Palestine. They began emigrating to Palestine as colonists, where they started dispossessing indigenous Muslim and Christian Palestinians. In November 1947, following World War II and the Holocaust, the newly created United Nations approved a plan to divide Palestine into Jewish and Arab states, against the will of the majority indigenous Palestinian Arab population. It gave 56% of the land to the proposed Jewish state, despite the fact that Jews owned only about 7% of the private land in Palestine and made up only about 33% of the population, a very large percentage of whom were recent immigrants from Europe. The Palestinian Arab state was to be created on just 42% of Palestine, even though Muslim and Christian Palestinians made up a large majority of the population and were indigenous to all of the land. Jerusalem was to be governed by a special international administration. Almost immediately after the partition plan was passed, the expulsion of Palestinians by Zionist militias began, months before the armies of neighboring Arab states became involved. By the time these militias and the new Israeli army finished, the new state of Israel covered 78% of Palestine. The remaining 22%, comprising the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, fell under the control of Jordan and Egypt, respectively. In the 1967 war, the Israeli military occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, which Israel began colonizing shortly afterwards. Between 750,000 and 1 million are the number of Palestinians expelled from their homeland and made refugees by Zionist militias and the new Israeli army during Israel's establishment, amounting to approximately 75% of all Palestinians. Between 250 and 350,000 are the number of Palestinians driven from their homes by Zionist militias between the passage of the UN partition plan on November 29, 1947, and the establishment of Israel on May 25, 1948, prior to the outbreak of war with neighboring Arab states. Several dozen massacres occurred, carried out by Zionist militias and the Israeli army, which played a critical role in prompting the flight of many Palestinians from their homes, very similar to what's going on today. And it goes on. And approximately 150,000 were the number of Palestinians who remained inside what became Israel's borders. Those are quick facts, the Palestinian Nakba from the Institute for Middle East Understanding. Now, let me pull this up. So I found a really interesting article. Seeing as how nobody's calling me up just yet, I will continue with this until you do. 503-231-8187. This is an article called Blood and Oil, a Middle East Primer for UE Members. Not sure who wrote. Oh, Peter Gilmore. I don't know if he wrote this. Okay, I'll just read this. By Peter Gilmore, UE News Managing Editor from 1984 to 2006. This came out in 2017, this piece, on the ueunion.org website. This UE News feature was originally written in 2002 with President Trump's announcement this week that he intends to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and relocate the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv. We are republishing it to give UE members and our allies important background on the Middle East. The Middle East, the home of ancient civilizations and holy lands and war. The crises of the Middle East seem to defy understanding or solution. The history of the region does suggest answers, however. In the Middle East, politics and the incessant drumbeat of war ultimately have everything to do with a substance more valuable than gold, oil. The modern problems in the region result not from ancient hostilities, but from the actions of modern governments on behalf of big business. To understand what's going on in the Middle East today, we need to go back only 100 years. A century ago, the map looked much different. There was no Iraq, no Jordan, no Israel, no Lebanon. The Ottoman Empire, stretching from the Balkans to North Africa, enveloped much of the region. Powerful industrialized European nations with empires of their own, especially Great Britain, had a keen interest in the Middle East. Britain had already seized the southwestern tip of the Arabian Peninsula from the Ottoman Empire and forced the rulers of small territories along the Persian Gulf to sign treaties, placing their foreign affairs in British hands. Britain backed Ibn Saud, whose family had been the traditional leaders of a fundamentalist Islamic sect, in his bid to become the ruler of a small peninsular kingdom. Britain's goal was to safeguard the sea route through the Suez Canal to India, then a valuable part of its worldwide empire. To head off the Russian Empire's advances toward southward, Britain signed a treaty with Russia in 1907 that divided Iran, Persia, into three zones, one British, one Russian, one neutral. How very interesting. This all goes back so far. Without the Iranian government's knowledge or involvement, Britain was already interested in oil, Iranian and otherwise. Today's British Petroleum can be traced back to the Anglo-Persian Oil Company founded in 1909. The British government soon acquired a controlling interest in the company. The outbreak of World War I in 1914 and the Ottoman Empire's alliance with Germany gave Britain and other imperial powers new opportunities to help themselves to the region's riches. And of course, all these things are so complex. The Ottoman Empire's alliance with Germany, you know, it's well known that there's Arabs who supported Hitler, but you know, a lot of elements of the United States supported Hitler, business leaders, and even political leaders. You know, there's hope that Hitler would kill off the Soviet Union, and then we could deal with Hitler. Yeah, right. So anyway, it's such a complex history, and you know, there's a lot of people who point. You know, it's true, and I'm not painting anybody as a necessarily a good guy or well, there's some obvious bad guys. You know, certainly Hitler, and. Anyway, we could talk about that, but you know, I just these things. I don't know this history well enough to be able to really give you the full picture. But I'll limit myself to reading this. But yeah, these things are very complex. There, you know, there's reasons why people make what they think might be temporary alliances. You know, the Ottoman Empire was in conflict with Great Britain, with the British Empire. And Germany, you know, their ambitions were to be their own global empire, which maybe some people didn't see right off the bat. Anyway, so the outbreak of World War I in 1914 and the Ottoman Empire's alliance with Germany gave Britain and other imperial powers new opportunities to help themselves to the region's riches. Britain and Russia reached a new agreement in 1915, dividing up Iran and Turkey. Britain and France likewise made plans to divvy up much of the Middle East between them once the war was won. At the same time, Britain encouraged Arab revolts against the Ottoman Empire with the promise that victory would lead to a united Arab nation reaching from the Red Sea to the Persian Gulf. River to the sea. Anyway, reaching from the Red Sea to the Persian Gulf. And in November 1917, British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour wrote to the Zionist leader Lord Rothschild promising British government support for, quote, the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The Zionist movement, which originated in Europe, sought creation of a Jewish state. The British government had promised the same country to two nations. I wonder if that's where it all started. At the war's end, private interests, hopeful of exploiting the region's oil, urged their governments to ignore wartime promises to Arab leaders. a variety of small, divided Arab states would be much easier to maneuver into oil deals than a large, independent Arab republic. The European powers agreed. France assumed control of Syria and Lebanon. Britain took Palestine and Mesopotamia. London granted local control to kings and sheikhs favorable to British interests. These arrangements were ratified by the League of Nations, the precursor to the United Nations. Fancy that. Britain's Palestinian colony was officially a League mandate, and that's where the State of Israel, its origins began. And then it goes on, the new states needed boundaries. 5 days of wrangling over the borders at a conference in Baghdad ended with Sir Percy Cox, British High Commissioner, arbitrarily drew the boundary line, setting off Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Anyway, it's and it talks about the rush for oil. The confirmation of oil beneath Iraqi soil led to intense wrangling among imperialist interests, resulting in the 1928 Red Line Agreement. The Anglo-Persian Oil Company, Royal Dutch Shell, the French Oil Company, CFP, Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon and Mobil, Atlantic Petroleum, Gulf Oil, and Standard Oil of Indiana, now Amoco, formed a joint venture called the Near East Development Company. The new company was required to cooperate with a Turkish petroleum company, itself 50% owned by Anglo-Persian. The agreement allowed for oil drilling rights in the old Ottoman Empire, with a red line drawn on the map to indicate the boundaries of the bonanza. The line ran from Turkey through Jordan, Syria, and Iraq to the southern tip of Saudi Arabia, excluding Kuwait and Iran. And it goes on and on. I can't read the whole thing. It's really brilliant. Again, this article is called Blood and Oil, a Middle East Primer for UE Members. Interesting. All these, you know, the United European Union, you know, has been a largely a guarantor of the status quo, both capitalist and nation state. But within it, there have been, you know, counter trends, just like within the United Nations. There have been, you know, some things that have been led to some helpful developments. So that's in the www.ueunion.org. It's from 2017, Blood and Oil, a Middle East Primer. And I got all sorts of, I didn't get around to making up a program page. Hopefully I will be able to do that and put some of these on there. I have a few other things I want to bring into this, but it looks like maybe we got a caller. Looks like Francis. Go ahead, you're on the air.
I just tuned in, so I'm not sure what you have said already about the situation in Palestine. I am dismayed by the fact that now they're calling the demonstrators pro-Hamas rather than pro-Palestine. And I need to know more about Hamas's history. I know it started out as a resistance to the apartheid that's been going on in Palestine since 1948. I think it was on Arab Voices on cable last week was a speech by a doctor, and I can't remember his name, but then right after him was Representative Al Green from Texas, and he said everything I've been thinking and feeling. It was like, oh, what he said. I kept saying, yeah, what he said, because he put it all down, and he spoke about the babies. And I don't know how, somehow, because we say that Hamas is using human shields, that makes it okay to bomb babies. Just because they say that Hamas is using them as human shields, that means we can go ahead and bomb them? It's not logical. And to children in the world who see this in the year 2024, that grown people can't sit down and resolve these conflicts without bombing babies is kind of ridiculous. It's absurd, and I'm not sure why anyone thinks that they would consider that self-defense.
Oh no, it's self-defense is just their you know, their propagandistic
exactly, and it's obvious.
Right, as I was saying, you missed the whole account a whole historical framing of this in the context of the creation of the state of Israel.
No, I am very aware of that, okay. And I've been aware of it for years, and so have a whole lot of other people. So I'm more interested in how Hamas formed, because I know it formed as a resistance.
Well, I can read to you that.
And now,
okay,
go ahead.
Well, I can read to you the Wikipedia page, you know, which I just pulled up, and other people might have something to say. I mean, my quick take on it is that whatever their politics, their religious affiliations, and it's clearly known that they're actually encouraged by the state of Israel. They're tolerated and at times encouraged Islamic activists and groups as a counterweight to the secular nationalists of the PLO and its dominant faction, Fatah. That goes back to, you know, 1967 and probably further back. And so, yeah, but my, you know, what I say is that Palestine should be treated by all of us as a nation state, because that's what, you know, that's what gives you some, you know, I disagree with the existence of nation states in a theoretical sense. But the world being as it is, that's the only thing that would guarantee them some kind of standing. And so if they are a nation state, they should be entitled to their own self-defense. And that's what Israel constantly claiming self-defense has to suppress,
right.
That the Palestinians,
right.
That would the Hamas would be either a militia like the Israelis have, and an army, or their army, you know, they haven't been able to form
right.
an army because they don't have status as a state, and their ability to really, if they really had an ability to defend themselves, I hate to say it, but the reason why, you know, I don't think this should be a controversial statement, the reason why Palestinians have resorted to, from, you know, kids throwing rocks to bombing buses to the Hamas incredibly radical action on October 7th, where they flew over the fence with their vehicles and did this somewhat unprecedented and relatively small scale in the scheme of things. I mean, it was horrible. There's lots of Israelis killed, but in the scheme of things, the hundreds of thousands of people displaced and killed, it's an unusual thing. But yeah, they can't talk about the ability of the Palestinians to have real self-defense. Because that would call into question again the legitimacy of the state of Israel and their
right.
basically their plan from the very beginning to have it all. And that's what I heard a really good thing on, I can't remember where it was, it might have been Democracy Now, where they don't believe in either a two-state or a one-state solution. Their plan all along has been a constant attrition, constant grinding down, and then using these opportunities, like in some ways gifted to them by the Hamas attack, to just completely annihilate the population of Gaza and force them to flee. You know, where would they flee to? But anyway, that's
exactly. Right. And if you Google this, insert open air prison, just put that in there. The first thing that comes up is a map of Gaza and the West Bank. Mm-hmm. So they've been in that state of apartheid since 1948. And I think that we also don't, everybody kind of sidesteps the fact that there's a whole lot of money being made dropping those 2,000-pound bombs on babies.
Indeed.
And the war machine is alive and well. And while as long as that is in the mix and influencing decisions, I don't know that we'll ever have a reasonable solution, because making war makes money. And
yeah. Well, we got another caller.
All right, then. Well, you have a good day, and okay. Thanks for having that conversation.
Yeah, and thanks for calling
Bye-bye.
In.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Yeah, and I've actually got a interesting article about how the global oil industry is fueling Israel's war in Gaza, obviously, not just the military, well, it's part of the military-industrial complex. Anyway, let's go to our, I'll read a little bit of that if I get a chance. God, we're already almost 10 minutes from the end of the show. Hi, James, you got the forum.
Hello. Yes. Thank you so much for all of the work you've done to put this together. I was hesitant to call because I didn't want to interrupt. But, you know, the situation in Israel and the Middle East is often just baffling. And our government's response to the situation is just baffling. Like, you know, knowing what we stand for, why are we acting the way we do in that situation?
What do you mean, knowing what we stand for?
Well,
that's problematic.
Well, there are some principles that we claim to be based upon, that our government is based upon, and they just don't seem to apply in this situation. And it just baffles me that why aren't we doing what we say we're all about in that situation?
Well, no, my point was from the very beginning of the show was that one of the reasons we can't is because we were founded on settler colonialism,
exactly.
just like Israel. And so it
exactly.
calling into question the circumstances surrounding the creation of Israel calls inherently in some ways, you know, maybe that doesn't seem obvious to people, it calls into the question the circumstances of the creation of the United States of America.
Yeah.
And the deep state, as it were, I hate to use that term, but there kind of is the deep state, meaning, you know, the hard-boiled, never question, you know, the rightness of the United States and its imperial destiny, manifest destiny. So anyway, that's...
No, I agree completely with what you're saying. But, you know, what you just did on the show, this historical background, adds a lot of information as to why we're reacting the way we do and why the situation is the way it is. But and your use of the word deep state, I'm not a deep state fan either, but I've often faced with this bafflement. I wonder if we know all the circumstances, all the diplomatic agreements and the secret defense arrangements in that region, and I'm wondering if that could explain some of this, disconnect between our so-called morals and what we're doing in the Middle East. That there's more to it than what we're seeing.
Indeed.
Not that it's. I don't want to use the word deep state either, but that our international politics in that region are based on secret agreements that we don't really know, and I'm wondering if it's time to come clean and hear, you know, get the history that you just laid out into the public so that everybody knows.
Well,
and in addition, explain what we're doing in Israel, what we get from defending Israel like we do, and what Israel gets from us, and have it all out on the table so that we could, as a country, could face it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I think, you know, that's what these new youth-based movements for questioning the existence of the police, you know, questioning the whole legacy of colonialism. That's what they're, and, you know, questioning the role of the university. First time really, you know, since the 60s, although there was the anti-apartheid movement, that was a little more limited. There was a, you know, calling to question the role of the university in the military-industrial complex. Anyway, we got another caller. And
thank you,
James.
Thank you.
I want to read a little bit before we go to our next caller. Nick Estes has a really interesting article. He's with the Red Nation, a Native American reflection on the Nakba. While the Nakba was taking place in Palestine, Native peoples in the United States faced what is known as the Era of Termination. Termination was the attempt by the federal government, starting in the 1940s, to completely liquidate all tribal assets and landholdings and to privatize all of the remaining land bases and make, quote, full citizens of Native people. I guess that's the one state solution in the United States. The two state is what some Native Americans still advocate, is to actually have complete sovereignty for the Native nations and actually restore some or all of their original territories. But anyway, some termination laws remained on the books until 1980. In the U.S., termination was meant to forcibly assimilate Native peoples into white culture, while in Palestine, Zionism emphasized segregating Jews and Arabs instead. But in both places, dispossession and expulsion were the order of the day. For my family and my tribe specifically, the 1940s ushered in what was called the Pick Sloan Plan, which was a series of hydroelectric dams on our river. The Missouri River at the time was one of the largest dam systems in the world. Of course, this is what my co-host Jacqueline Keeler talks a lot about. I can't read all that. I did want to get to another caller, but I also did want to remind you that to support these voices and to support this kind of history, to support this programming, you can do that by supporting our spring membership drive, which we're in until May 25th with a $60,000 goal. We're trying to get our way there, and we have a couple weeks left. And you can go to kboo.fm/give. I believe that's still working. And you can also mail it into 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. You can text KBOO to 44321. We are, as far as I know, the oldest independent, that is non-Pacifica, community radio station in the land. And we have been doing this for 54 years, and we want to keep doing it for a lot longer. We have some of the few call-in talk radio programs, progressive, in the Portland area. And I know you appreciate this, so please show your appreciation right now by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 on your mobile device or mail it in, as I said. Let's see who we got up next. We have an anonymous person. Go ahead. You're on. No, we have wrong. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, we have an anonymous caller. Go ahead. You're on the air. Oh, you hung up. Do we have Ron? Go ahead, Ron.
Hey, one lens to look at this through is the fact that Israel is, their purpose as far as the U.S. and Great Britain and maybe even France are concerned, is their guardian over the Middle East to tamp down, which is one of the reasons why they keep bombing Syria and Iran. They're looking out for our interests. I say our, which,
right.
You know what I'm saying. U.S. and Great Britain interests in the Middle East over the oil. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're aware of how the CIA undermined the democratic elections in 1953 of Iran. Israel is one of basically an operative, the major operative in the Middle East for Great Britain and the U.S. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why the U.S. Supports almost anything. Well, I won't even say almost anything. Anything that Israel does. Biden's trying to look like he's trying to be more objective with this last crap that he's come up with. It's not sending them some 2,000-pound bombs, which can be used. I mean, it's not gonna fly. We might be looking at Trump as our next president, but
that's what's kind of shocking is that, you know,
that's what's scariest for us.
Let alone the Bernie Sanders challenge, unfortunately didn't go very far, but did activate. It did help. I think it did help create helped spur some more youthful activism, even though he's an old man himself. But he had young ideas, or at least some fresh ideas. That challenge never really got very far with the Democratic Party. Maybe it helped a brief surge in some progressive candidates, but they're still so marginalized. And this whole just gives them a, you know, they think it gives them, I guess, an opportunity to continue to have the military industrial Democrats continue to have hegemony over the Democratic Party, unfortunately. And it's gonna, it could lead to their complete downfall, and who knows where that's gonna lead to us.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, but I've always thought that Israel was going to be the downfall of the U.S. and we're inching, and we're I say inching, but now we're getting more that way by even larger I don't know, a larger scale than before.
It does seem that way.
Yeah. However, you know, best prepare for the worst because it's coming. So anyway, well, I'm just saying that because I just want to make everybody aware. They're wondering why we back Israel so okay. much. Well, that's why.
Right. We got it. We got to go, Ron. Thank you for calling. And
all right.
Yeah. And it's coming. And also the extremely high recent temperatures could rise even more. I'm going to talk about that next week. That's the other legacy of this whole historical process that we're in denial about. But I got to go. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Ty, for running the board. Bye, everybody.
Your unkindness rewrote my autobiography. Punchlines in guts, blades for tongues, and a mouth pregnant with thunder. Your unkindness told me to push through, look, listen. I was born on the 50th anniversary of the Nakba, to a mother that reaped olives and figs and other Quranic verses. What dini was zaytun? My name, a bomb in a white room, a walking suspicion in an airport, choiceless politics. I was born on the 50th anniversary of the Nakba.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area, and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
The flowers are blooming, the birds are singing, and KBOO's spring membership drive is back. If you enjoy alternative radio that pushes the status quo, then support KBOO by becoming a member today. Donate